Hello, and welcome to a roundtable discussion on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, I'm joined by guests for a lively conversation on a topic we hope you'll find interesting. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on The Lost Fleet Courageous, which is the third book in the Lost Fleet series.
By Jack Campbell.
By Jack Campbell, yeah. I first discovered this property through the comic, which actually takes place, I think, after most of the novels, if not all of the novels.
Interesting.
And after I read this, before we started talking about it, I reread the comic, Lost Fleet Corsair, which has effectively a couple of spoilers for some stuff. And at one point I had asked you a question about what systems they'd gone through, because I thought they had referenced one of them there, and they had. This continues the saga from the first two books, not like literally right on the heels, but like shortly thereafter, like days, if that.
Yeah.
But the previous one didn't end on a cliffhanger. You could argue if this one did or not. It ended on and here's what we're going to do next.
Yes.
So not literally a cliffhanger, but a clear trajectory for the next.
Well, up until this book, it's been this hero from the past, resurrected from survival sleep, who's bringing back the ancient knowledge and the ancient lessons of warfare, if you will, mm-hmm. to the good guys, and teaching them how to fight, teaching how to not blindly charge ahead, but to use fleet formations and things.
Because their standards and practices had slowly devolved over a century to where it was seen as good to go rush headlong into battle, mm-hmm. kill the enemy over, like, surviving.
Yes.
So over the century, they'd pretty much killed off their smarter captains.
Yeah.
And you're left with just that blind rush.
Yes.
And it was interesting because one of the points that was made in this book, and I honestly don't remember how well it had been set up because it hadn't caught me at all, was when Gary realizes that the captains of, was it the battleships were causing the problems, and the battle cruisers were the really sharp ones.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
One class of ship over the other,
yeah,
and I
exactly.
may have gotten it backwards.
And I can't remember which it was, but when he suddenly realized all the troublemakers are assigned to a specific class of ship, and it's the slow, plodding ship we act to defend.
The big, strong ship.
Yes.
That can take a beating, and basically, you don't have to be as good of a captain there, because it'll make up for it.
Yes.
You're more durable and such. And then later, he'd realized that pretty much all of the really bad problem captains were in this one group.
Yes.
And that had been kind of the dumping ground.
Yeah.
It was interesting how he was making those realizations and then trying to figure out, well, what do I do about it?
Yes. Well, and what happens in the course of this book is he's been successfully teaching the Alliance fleet these old ways of fighting, these formations, etc. And he gets a real rude shock when he discovers the enemy's been paying attention.
Yes. He's made his side better, but in doing so, he's making the other side a bit better.
Yeah.
What was interesting is they were following his lead by copying what he was doing, but they hadn't learned the lessons, and they were slavishly following versus understanding the tactic.
Yeah.
And adapting.
Yeah, which was very interesting as well.
I mean, there's a lot of levels of learning, and in some schools of thought, there's the kind of flail around blindly, then there's the, okay, you've got a pattern to follow, so you slavishly follow the pattern,
mm-hmm.
then you understand the pattern, and then you know when to use it and when not to use it, and how to use it.
Yes.
And it was interesting watching kind of that cat and mouse. As they do one thing, he does another. As he does something, they learn, they adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that back and forth was interesting, was entertaining. And there were a couple of times some of the fleet maneuvers we got here were fascinating, but I, again, wanted to have...
They were hard to visualize.
Yeah, I wanted to have a movie or TV kind of incarnation where you see him call the tactic and you see the fleet do
yes.
what it does.
Yeah.
Because it's definitely hard to visualize, you know, And the author does a good job describing it.
Oh, he does. He does. But when you have the fleet divide into five formations that are moving like five coins, and at first they're all flat on the plane, if you will, of space, but then two of the formations move at 90 degrees and stay in that rotation, but two of them move at 90 degrees, but then another 45 degrees.
They're pivoting on multiple angles, sometimes at once. It was one or two times the comment in the book was that without automated navigation, this would have been too complicated for somebody to do.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, yeah, because I can't follow it.
Well, and there were other times when he was pointing out that you're having to estimate and guess to the best of your ability when their equipment is actually going to show them because of this time-late speed of light,
yeah,
relay of information, what you've done, and then you're waiting until the last realistic second that you can change your formation such that you're not where their equipment says you ought to be because they don't know you move.
Well, and that's what makes this seem like a turn-based strategy game.
Yeah.
There are certain intervals you can make decisions based on what you know, but you're kind of locked in for a certain amount.
There were times when I got confused. Like, at one point, someone came through the Hypernet gate, and it's, they saw us the moment they arrived, but we didn't see them for 5 hours until the light traveled to us.
What's happening there is if you've been in the system for 5 hours, the lights already had time to get there.
Okay.
They just showed up.
And met the light, effectively.
The light hadn't bounced off them yet.
Okay. That's why I wasn't...
It makes sense when you stop and think about it that way, but it could have been explained a little bit better.
Yeah.
And that's part of why they have the co-president there, is so there are times where Gary or Desjani, the captain of the Dauntless, can explain the seemingly rudimentary things.
Yeah. Well, and by having the lone civilian, you have someone for the military types to explain the military aspects to, but you also have someone to explain the civilian side and the political side to the military types.
Well, it's a common narrative technique to have somebody new to the situation, the environment, whatever.
Yeah.
So you can start a story with, here's the grand tour, here's what you need to know, and fill the reader in with that character.
Yes.
And there are multiple characters that have been playing that role.
Yes.
Gary, the time, you know, displaced person, is needing to get up to speed on the current technology and situation and whatnot. The co-president, who's the non-military person who has to ask those questions. There's Johnny, who is a capable captain, but doesn't understand John Gary's approach to battle, so she's got to ask the questions for him to explain.
Yes.
And doing it in a way that it feels natural, it should come out or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
The author's doing a great job with that.
Yes.
You know, because it never feels like, geez, you're just bogging me down in exposition.
Yeah.
There are other times I'd like maybe a little more here or there just because I need my memory jogged, whatever. But like when they had the mobile mining units.
Moomoos.
The Moomoos. And at one point, Captain Gary had to basically call somebody, and it's like, so what exactly do these things do, and how do they work?
They haven't changed much in a century.
Yeah. The technology is ancient, and he's like, yeah, but I didn't need to know back then. I kind of want to know now.
Yeah.
But it felt natural. It yes. made sense. And having the people that can take the methodology or whatever and dumb it down.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Gary being time displaced.
Yes.
How accurate can you fire one of these weapons if I've got Marines on the ground?
Mm-hmm.
And somebody saying, well, I could do it and it's going to be off by, you know, centimeters. They're 10 meters away. They're fine. And he's like, yeah, I don't know that I'd want to stand 10 meters away. No matter how good your shooter is, your gunner is.
Yeah.
And then he's calling the Marines. Well, what do you think? You know, 200 meters? How about 300? 300 it is.
Yeah.
You know, the negotiation back and forth.
Yes.
And there was a lot of, again, the cat and mouse of what are they thinking, what are we thinking.
Well, the co-president did a great job in that time frame of the story, pointing out people are bluffing you.
Mm-hmm.
And because military people are so used to basically being honest in their tactics, you know, if we say we planned a bomb, we planned a bomb. We don't act like we planted a bomb, so you'll be scared of the bomb and go looking for the bomb because we're buying time.
Yeah. It comes down to different people are looking at the situation through different lenses, seeing different things, and then can they convince other people of that?
Yes.
That often would come out during the captain meeting or whatever, where somebody, you know, he starts, well, we're going to do this, and somebody automatically jumps down his throat, and he's like, can I explain the plan first?
Yeah.
It's interesting how there's been that rotating negative voice captain.
Yeah.
You think you've gotten rid of the bad seed, and somebody else is pulling the string.
Well, yeah, the co-president has been pointing out from, I think, book one, you know, the voice here in the meeting is not the actual troublemaker.
At this point, we still don't know who the main contender for the throne, I guess, would be for running the fleet.
Yeah.
Other people are trying to chip away at Gary, but who's...
The one scene I wish we'd gotten, and really I think it should have been in book two, what we got in book two was Gary sending a message that he knew basically nobody can get an answer to us in time. But when they're at the Hypernet gate trying to deal with the destruction as it's happening, and he sends out that message saying, if I don't survive, Duellus takes over as fleet commander. We never really got a I dub thee thine heir.
Did he do that publicly or just tell Duellus?
Oh no, he sent that to fleet-wide.
Okay, all right.
When he was afraid that the Dauntless was going to get destroyed. But we never had follow-up. We never had confirmation the fleet received the message. It was just kind of thrown out there, and then in like this book we had Duellus saying, you know, I want you to live and make it because I don't want to have to step up and take your shoes.
I don't want the job.
Yeah.
Well, I'm kind of thinking, because I think there's three more books in this arc, and I think there may be two other arcs.
Interesting.
Potentially from different vantage points. But in this one, I kind of want to see there come a point where the Dauntless gets some serious pounding. Gary gets hurt and is out of action for a little bit. And how does the fleet respond?
Yeah.
The problem with that is the way this story is being told from Gary's perspective that almost forces a time jump, even if it's a couple of days.
I want Gary either confined quarters or confined to the medical bay. For recovery.
I'm just thinking if the ship gets bounced around, he's knocked out, he comes to a day or two later or whatever.
Oh, but I'm thinking if you've got him down in the medical bay with two broken legs, two broken arms, and a spine...
They can't go that far, but yeah.
Well, but you know what I mean. It's, you know, you lay in this bed for 48 hours or you're paralyzed. And we're still getting it from his perspective as he's going nuts with the whole, I'm having to trust them, which we've gotten in different ways in previous stories.
The problem with that is the way they've set it up, he can do so much from his stateroom or from a medical bed. That's why I'm thinking he would have to be unconscious for a period of time for things to start to unravel, and then for him to have to pull it together.
Yeah. But see, I question would things unravel. I want it to be in book five, where all the people who have been learning from him, have been getting the training, have 2 days to prove that the previous 4.5 books have been worth the journey.
Well, and we've seen a number of cases where, like the group that held back to protect the fleet.
Yes.
Doing what he literally had done.
Yes.
That people are learning those lessons.
And volunteering to do it because they realized he didn't want to order anyone to do it. And them finally understanding in that moment as they volunteered why he had volunteered 100 years before to do the same thing.
But there are also other people that are still so bullheaded to not be on that learning curve.
Well, and we've got at least one captain came pretty darn close to admitting that his former captain is supposed to be arrested, confined to quarters, or in some way in the brig, whatever, and yet he basically admitted he's still taking orders from that captain because, you know, he's got a good head on his shoulders.
But that's where I think things could fall apart in literally a day or so of the fleet being in who's in control, you know, chaos. There was some good political stuff between all of that going on.
We did get the co-president's the specter of her husband.
Yes, you would call that last book in terms of where that was going. And that's where the author is doing a good job of foreshadowing.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got enough information to say, well, I think it may be this. But not something where, well, of course it's that. It couldn't be anything else. Or where the hell did that come from?
Well, and the way it was dealt with in this book, we don't actually know if we're going to find that long-lost husband, whether he's dead or alive. And in some respects, that doesn't matter. Because they've managed to paint a picture where the very fact he could be alive calls into question the honor of both John Geary and the co-president, depending how other people view it, talk about it, etc.
Well, and his stand of that over the century, honor's gotten to the point where it's nothing but self-recrimination for anything you do, almost.
Yeah.
And kind of the, you were acting in good faith, you walked her through, if positions were reversed, would your husband want you to be happy, you know, kind of
thing. Yeah.
So I thought that was well handled. It was a good subplot for Geary and the co-president, but also the co-president and Captain Desjani.
Yes. Well, and there was a very good section in there on you cannot accept forgiveness until you are willing to forgive yourself.
Yeah, but it also is something that seems to be foreshadowing something in book 4, 5, or 6.
Yeah.
Either the husband shows up alive, dead, something.
Yeah.
And if the author doesn't touch on that, I'd be disappointed.
Yes, I agree with that.
But it's very clear that seeds have been planted for later books, which in my mind implies a certain amount of having pre-planned a few things.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a couple of places where, you know, how long can we stay in jump space or whatever.
That's changed a lot since book one.
And it was something that was just thrown out in book one. Oh, it's 3 weeks here. It's, well, two's a long time.
Yeah, two's...
So, there could have been a little tighter aspect on that.
Yeah, and I think book two, it was said that 2 weeks was longer than anyone had ever been in jump space, according to the people we're currently serving with. And Geary had to basically say, no, if you go look at the records from my time, you'll see it was longer.
And again, fine with that, except for the fact they'd done 3 weeks before. You know,
it's
one of those things, a minor inconsistency.
Yeah.
Which isn't a big deal, but...
Well, and I had the feeling that the author was trying to speed up the time frame and was feeling like 2 and 3 weeks in jump space was allowing too much time for repairs, too much time for restocking weapons, too much time for making more fuel cells, and was kind of decreasing the urgency each time they arrived in a star system.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the equivalent to the ticking clock. So I felt that he was trying to cut down dramatically the amount of time they had to prepare and recoup between battles.
That does seem like the sort of thing the author may have realized they maybe should have done differently from the get-go, had they thought, you know, 3, 4, 5 books in.
Yeah.
And no doubt, he put the first book out there and let's see how it goes.
Yeah. Well, and it may be something that kind of some more experienced author read the first book and said, hey, you know, if I were you, I would have.
You never know.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that I think as an author gets more and more into the world, things tweak. It's like you watch a TV pilot and then you watch the series that comes after that. There's often things that you see in the pilot. Sometimes it's physical location. Sometimes it's characters. Sometimes it's tone, style. Is this, are they friends? Are these people antagonists? Whatever.
Yeah.
That shift drastically.
Yeah.
Just because, well, we started here, but we ended up a little off on that because we realized this is a good actor. The audience is responding well, or they're not. Let's go this way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The deeper in you get, the more you realize where you've got to course correct.
Yeah.
And there's been a little course correction here and there, but nothing that's just crazy, you know, a radical shift or something.
Well, one of the things that I thought was done incredibly well in book three was bringing in Fighting Falco for a scene.
Yes. He came back because Geary basically wanted to see what he would do because the enemy was getting used to Gary's way of thinking.
Well, Gary's attitude was, I've done the expected. I've done the unexpected. The only thing left to do is the crazy or the insane, and I can't think what that would be, so I'll ask Fighting Falco.
I've got to do something I wouldn't do. What would that be?
Yeah, and, you know, as it played out, I was like, this actually makes perfect sense in the context of the story. I mean, it's not what I saw coming, or what I would have said, oh, wow, that's what I would do, but it works.
Well, and if you hadn't had a callback to Falco, it would have seemed like that was just an arc for the book and doesn't matter.
Yes.
And that sort of thing gives a sense of solidity to the universe.
Mm-hmm. And it was a nice way to check in on Falco and see how he was doing.
Yeah. Well, and give Gary not that reality check, but...
Oh, come on. What was it? Gary syndrome? Yes. That was a reality check.
When he's talking to the doctor and he's like, oh yeah, I see cases of Gary syndrome all the time. You know, this is a bad one, but...
Yeah.
And then Gary's gotta introduce himself.
Yeah.
And the co-president's response after the fact was basically, nobody can accuse you of being delusional and thinking you're John Gary.
Yes.
You are John Gary.
Yes.
So there was some fun aspects there. And that's a lot of what I enjoy about these novels is they read well. We're literally in the head of John Gary.
Yeah.
We're seeing things through his perspective. The author's playing fair, giving us what we need to kind of see some stuff coming if we see it.
Yes.
We at least got a chance.
Well, and I thought they did well with Lieutenant Riva.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed with that. That was the would-be boyfriend of Captain Desjani. And we got, and I forget if it was this book or the previous. The previous one set it up. Either late in that one, early in this one, they pushed, hey, it's going good. And then suddenly it's like, poof, it just blew up.
Mm-hmm.
And the rationale for why the relationship ended made sense.
It was a very good follow-up on his time as a POW, the consequences of all the time as a POW, and the difference in rank, and all the emotional problems. But it was also a Gary getting a reality check that he got so caught up, both in the fleet, big picture general, but also in his own personal problem, that he forgot to be checking in with his key personnel and making sure they were doing okay.
But Riva was time displaced to a degree by being a POW for, what, 10 years or something?
Yeah.
And seeing how everyone else had moved on and he hadn't, which is, again, a parallel to Gary.
Yes.
So the author is exploring the Gary situation, using Falco as a mirror.
Yes.
Using Riva as a mirror.
Yes.
Using, to a degree, Desjani.
Yes.
As a mirror. And even kind of the co-president at times. So we're getting all those different angles, which is part of what's making the character seem a lot more fully realized than a lot of other characters in these sorts of sci-fi novels.
Well, I thought it was funny that one of the characters that got a name was Iger down in Intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the watchstanders on the bridge don't get named. And we spend a lot of time on the bridge.
Yeah, Iger in Intelligence is interesting. There was the joke of, you know, I signed up for this, I didn't have to.
Yes.
That's, I guess, why they put me in Intelligence. I guess they seem to think I need it. You know, in kind of the self-deprecating humor and things like that.
Yeah.
But also with the slow reveal that on the enemy side, people are unhappy. They're speaking out openly in a society that doesn't allow that, but they're kind of having to because it's so damn common.
Well, and the syndics are aware that, our civilians don't like our government, what's going on, etc. However, fortunately for us, the Alliance is committing war crimes.
Yeah.
So as long
they still seem better than the enemy.
Yeah, yes. And that was eye-opening for Gary.
Well, and for some of the other people, it's like, how did you know?
Yes.
Why have you been being so nice? You knew this was, you know.
Yeah.
He's like, it was the right thing to do.
Yes.
You know, so being proven out on that certainly helped him. Yeah, the intelligence group, having studied the chatter in the enemy fleet, when they're in the system, they've got people coming in behind them. They're darting across the system. They've got two formations they've got to deal with. They've pretty much dealt with one, and then another contingent comes in. But what intelligence later realizes is the chatter on that is they weren't expecting to land in this system in the Hypernet.
Yeah, they thought they typed in the URL for Google, and suddenly they popped up at Yahoo.
Yeah.
And they were confused.
Now, my take on that is we've already gotten hints that the Hypernet may have been from a third party, maybe a non-human third party.
Mm-hmm.
And the implication was that that third party, non-human or not, doesn't matter, wanted the syndicate there.
Yes.
So they kind of, you know, redirected.
Mm-hmm.
But then the question was, okay, presumably they've got faster than light communication, which neither the Syndic nor the Alliance have. That's a big deal. But how did they know where Gary's was?
Yeah.
My theory is it's the Hypernet key.
Oh, interesting. That would make sense.
If the Hypernet key is essentially a homing beacon, and they not only know where all of the gates are,
yes,
but where people are going between them.
Yeah.
So they could basically say, this goes here now.
Yeah, that's smart, yeah.
So I'm curious how that's going to play out, because I think that was, again, the groundwork was laid for that.
Yes.
I think you got to look for it. It's not just, well, of course, because he flat out told us. It's there's exposition in places, but not in a lead me by the nose kind of a way.
There's definitely, though, been an undertone of nobody knows how the war was started. Nobody knows why the first shot was fired. So we're getting more and more of a, we've got Party A fighting against Party B, but it's...
When it was C that may have thrown the first volley in each direction and gotten the hell out of Dodge.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's kind of my take on what started the war. But that's the sort of thing that once it gets rolling, it takes care of itself.
Well, at one point, because Gary realizes he's not an intelligence officer and there's a lot that's happened in 100 years that he may not understand, he tells Iger, please look at XYZ. Tell me what you think. And Iger's response is basically, I take it you've already looked at all that. Yes, I have. And I have my own theories, but I want to hear yours.
Yeah, that's something that should come up probably next book, possibly may hold off to the book after it.
Yeah.
The other thing I was thinking in this book is they've been jumping system to system a lot.
Yes.
And each system, there are only so many other systems you could get to.
Yeah.
And they'd hit one or two places where from point A, you can go to B or C. From B or C, you can both get to D.
Yes.
You know, so there's some space geometry, if you will.
Yes.
But just going back through the novels, okay, we're starting here. Here's the web out the tree structure from there. We get to this other spot. Here's the tree. You know, what is that geometry?
Yeah.
What are those nodes? What are those edges? What does that graph look like?
Yeah.
Because I think the author's planned it out and, you know, maybe winging it as he goes, but tracking it as he goes.
I think so.
So I appreciate that aspect because it makes it, again, feel more tangible, more consistent, more real.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that I was not overjoyed with the way the book ended. We've come out of the jump. I know what we're going to do, Gary says, basically. We're going to turn around and go back. It's like, you came out of that surviving, but not in good shape. You haven't restocked, you know, whatever. Not saying it's a bad plan. I'm just saying, going to open with a bang next time.
Well, and I'm pretty sure there are mines waiting for them that they have to dodge as soon as they come out. Because they dodge.
I think he's got a game plan on that.
Well, he gave them orders to make a certain turn as they come out.
Yeah, but I think he's going to try to weaponize the enemy's minds against them.
Oh, interesting.
I'm not sure how.
Yeah.
But it could be that enemy's getting ready to go in right after them.
Well, part of me thinks he's hoping that the enemy that was right there followed them in.
Oh, that basically they cross paths again and miss each other.
Yeah.
Well, and this was the book that one of the systems they went to, the enemy had to start doing some changes in formation and just started crashing into each other.
Yes, because they were inexperienced pilots who didn't trust their automated controls and tried to take manual control.
But there was the scene where Gary's like, what's going on?
Yes.
You know, imagine if you had a bunch of, you know, army vehicles or whatever, and you put, you know, 15-year-olds in there that don't have their license.
Well, I was actually thinking simpler than that, the Indy 500. And you put 15-year-olds without licenses in there and told them they had to run the race at speed.
Yeah. It just takes one mistake and suddenly 8 cars spin out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's about what we saw.
But the rationale of the Syndic had so many places they had to go cover. This was low odds he'd come there, put the least experience on there. They shouldn't need to fight.
Yes.
So.
Well, and this was where we lost two ships. One that kind of we lost in the battle. It made sense. And one because they didn't trust the commands they were getting from fleet to stay with the fleet. And they went charging out of position. Even as Gary was screaming into the controls, you're going to be toast.
I think he's gotten a bit more benefit of the doubt with giving orders because people who follow him tend to do a lot better.
Yeah, yes. Well, and that's been one of the interesting conversations that's come up in these fleet conferences, is just because we're willing to die for the Alliance, just rushing to die.
There was a line in Babylon 5, The Legend of the Rangers. During Babylon 5, there was a group called the Rangers, and their motto was live for the one, die for the one.
Mm.
And the line in Legend of the Rangers, and it was from Jakar, live for the one, die for the one. Why is so much emphasis placed on the latter rather than the former?
Yeah.
Again, the glory of dying for the one versus living for the one.
Yeah.
And it was a great line.
Yeah.
Delivered beautiful. It's, again, that mindset that had developed on both the Alliance and Syndic worlds of rush to battle, the glory of the battle, kill as many as you can, even if you take most of your people with you.
Well, and they seemed to have gotten, and had the line in the previous book of, you know, he would have killed just as many if he'd told our ships to ram them. Because it was kind of a one-to-one law. And people are starting to realize when you fight Gary's way, you take out more than you lose.
Mm-hmm. But there was the one battle where they were just outclassed.
Yeah.
And they took a pound.
Yeah. And they all seem surprised at how upset Gary is by every loss.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that they're callous, and it's not that they're immune to the loss, but their entire lives have been full of the loss.
Well, so much so that the automated program that says what supplies you're going to need is expecting a certain amount of attrition of the ships.
Yeah.
You know, and Gary's style is counter to that.
I thought that was well done.
Yes.
Complete with the officers simply not understanding how the computer couldn't properly gauge weapons and fuel cells because it wasn't prepared for a fleet commander that didn't lose half his fleet in every battle.
That was one system they're going to adapt to his way of thinking. Last book, there was the how he searches or how he asks questions.
The query system.
The query system. Special subroutine for that 100-year-old dude.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's going to come back into the play next book or something.
You know, I was reminded within the past week that Americans versus non-Americans approach a situation and ask opposite questions.
Mm-hmm.
But most people answer without actually listening to the question, and they answer the question they assume was asked.
Yes.
And it's when you're in a situation where a restaurant or a cafeteria has a whole bunch of tables for 4 people, 6 people, whatever, and every table has at least 2 seats filled, so you're filling in those remaining seats. And some people say, is this seat taken? The other half say, may I join you?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a automatic response to, is this seat taken? No. Versus, may I join you? Yes.
Yeah. There's, I don't want to say glass half full, half empty aspect to that, but the language you speak, the way you're raised, etc., frames the way you think.
Yeah.
And in 100 years' time, those conditions can change radically. In this case, 100-year-long war.
Yes.
You know, when you've grown up in a situation where you, your parents, and grandparents have all lived and died with a never-ending seeming war.
Yeah.
You're going to think differently than people from a generation prior to that.
Well, one of the lines that Gary cut himself off from saying was about the food ration. And he was saying one of the flavors was so bad.
Oh, yeah.
They had wanted to trade it to the Syndics. But then they thought, we better not suggest that. It might cause a war.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like, yeah, it's funny before a century-long war.
Yeah.
Funnier.
Yes.
Yeah, there's, again, some good bits of humor and stuff. I'm enjoying this. I'm liking how it's going. I appreciate that it's not just, oh, we're stuck, boom, we get home. But we're now 3 books in. We're seeing progress. We're seeing change. It's good.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of, should they get home sooner? Should they not? It's a very fine balance.
Yeah.
Of how long can it take them to get home?
My gut says, since we know it's a 6-book arc, it's the whole 6-book arc to get home.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But my point was, should it be six books?
Yes.
You know, they've had enough trials and tribulations that they could have potentially at the end of book four, we may think, you know, it's time for them to move on.
Yeah. Well, and that goes back to my wishing I had a better concept of how far away were they? How many star systems away were they? Something I could visualize, understand, quantify.
A map of the system with durations.
Yeah.
Because if I were to map out star systems and there's a, well, it's this long of a jump sort of a deal, that gives a sense of scale.
Yeah.
Yeah. When he's saying this takes us in or back or forward through space of the opposition and whatnot helps, but not having an image of that at times is a little frustrating. I mean, yeah. Not majorly so.
No, but it makes it difficult.
I'd rather have had a map of the places they've gone through, or at least mentioned, versus the beginning of this, there was a list of which ships are in which section of the fleet.
And which ones were lost at which battles.
You've got 100 plus ships. That's too much for me to keep track of.
Yes.
I don't care.
Yeah. Well, and mostly for me, that was a skim the list and note, wow, we lost a lot in battle. It was trying to sink in how many we lost in the Syndicome system. How many were lost when the mutiny happened?
Yeah, yeah. And you need that sense of attrition, of loss, and of why. But that doesn't mean I need a list of all the ship names.
Yeah.
I can't keep it straight. And even getting that, not having the names of the captains with them.
Yes.
You know, it's hard to keep track.
Well, Duellos played just as big a role in this book as he has in the previous book, but this book had the name of his ship.
Yes. We've had enough captains and enough ships that it's hard for me to keep them straight in the way. Which class of ship is it? Is this one of the damaged ones? Is this one of the good captains, the bad captains?
Yes.
And it actually would have been nice for Gary to have been having a bit of a problem with that.
Yes.
Because he's not used to this big of a fleet.
Yeah. I mean, as it is, when he's in the fleet conferences, he takes advantage of the fact that when he looks at someone, it pulls up for him.
Yes.
Name and ship.
And again, were they to do this as a movie or TV show, that would be really handy.
Yes, it would. Yes.
What I would also add to that sort of a thing, particularly if I were doing it as a TV show, is bullet point notes.
Yeah.
This is so-and-so troublesome, you know, follows this guy. Trust, don't, you know, whatever. Private notes that Gary only sees.
Yeah.
So, it's a lot of fun. I'm enjoying this. I did reread The Lost Fleet Corsair, the 5-issue miniseries that Titan did. There were a couple of things that tied into what we've read so far, but it's also set after at least this series, and it seems like possibly at least one of the other two arcs they do.
Interesting.
Possibly after all the other stuff. I'm not sure. I haven't read the other stuff yet.
Yeah.
So there were a couple of things that is like, spoilers, but all right.
Yeah.
And I'm curious how many more novels, because there were 12 novels at least, then a pause of a year or so, and then two, it looked like prequel type things.
Along interesting.
The lines also when the comic was done. Is this still an active property or not? Does it all tie together? What's going on? You know, I want to learn more about the big picture of this stuff.
Yeah, me too.
It's fun. And typically I don't tend to go for the Warfleet sort of stories.
Mm-hmm.
But we're getting enough character and that sort of drama that I'm enjoying that part.
Yeah. And some pretty good world building.
Yeah. And again, the fair play, we're getting the information we need. It's not just getting dumped at the last minute of, oh yeah, I forgot to tell you this, that, and the other.
Yes.
That gets a little old.
Yeah.
So I'm enjoying it. I'm looking forward to the next one.
I agree.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.